Hi, Allison.
How are you doing?
I'm actually doing really great. It's been a good day.
Yeah? Why? Yeah.
I've been listening to our Patreon bloopers, extra clips from that got taken out of the episode that I just love listening to us talk to each other.
Is it so funny when you remember how ridiculous I can get?
And me too. I think I know. We have a lot of fun together.
Oh, it's the best. Where can I listen to that?
Patreon.com/UrsulaMajor.
Hey guys.
Hi.
Welcome to the Bitchery of History. I'm Allison.
My name is Max.
This week I'm going to be talking about Eowyn.
Yes.
From Lord of the Rings. Get ready. I'm so excited.
Me too. And I'm going to be talking about Jadis, the White Witch from the Chronicles of Narnia.
Oh yeah.
Yes.
Taking it back.
It's a fictive episode.
I love it. Yes. I love our fiction episodes. They're
Me
so good.
Too. So tell me all about Eowyn.
How much of a Lord of the Rings fan are you? Just want to know, like...
I'm a pretty big Lord of the Rings fan. Now, I say that I haven't read the books.
Okay, so I've read the books, so I have so, everything to tell you.
But here's the thing. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a household where everyone else has read the books.
Okay.
And they're obsessed with them.
I mean, for good reason.
So and I know a fair amount.
Eowyn is pretty much the dopest lady in the books.
Tell me about
it. So Eowyn is a fictional character in the book and the movie series, The Lord of the Rings. One of the best quotes, Eowyn quotes, is, "The women of this country learned long ago, those without swords can still die upon them."
Yes.
Get it, girl?
Mm-hmm.
So Eowyn comes from an old Welsh name
mm-hmm.
and means horse lover in Anglo-Saxon. Her other titles throughout the series include the Lady of Rohan, Lady of the Shield Arm, and Lady of Ithilien. That's her name later in the series.
Right.
So Eowyn is the daughter of Eomund and Théoden. She's the younger sister of Éomer and niece of King Théoden.
If you're having trouble placing her, she first appears in what, The Two Towers?
The Two Towers.
Okay.
Blonde hair.
Next to the...
King, next to
that Gandalf hits over the head.
Yes, yes, yes.
Sorry, keep going.
I was about to say, Eowyn is introduced in the second book, The Two Towers. King Théoden took in Éomer and Eowyn and raised them as his own children after their parents died.
Okay.
Now, during the War of the Ring, which is what the movies cover, because other backstory into The Lord of the Rings is there's so much history and so many stories that all take place
It's
more than Game of Thrones. So wrap your minds around that. So during the War of the Ring, which is what you see in The Fellowship of the Ring and The Two Towers and Return of the King and most of the movies, Eowyn stayed in Rohan. She's caring for her uncle, the king, who's being weakened by the influence of Saruman, the evil white wizard, through this guy called Wormtongue. And Wormtongue was poisoning Théoden with his words and convincing him that Saruman, the ultimate evil in Middle-earth, was good and you should totally do what he says and everything's going to be fine. And Wormtongue is super creepy towards Eowyn and has like a weird crush on her and that's harassment.
Yeah.
To bring it back to an earlier episode. So Eowyn is kind of trapped in this bleak life of caring for her uncle who's slowly going crazy and being hit on by this weirdo.
Right.
And then her brother is banished from Rohan. So she's left all alone and she's trapped there until Gandalf shows up and rescues everyone and then points out to Éomer how depressed Eowyn is. Gandalf says to Éomer, quote, "My friend, you had horses and deed of arms and free fields, but she, being born in the body of a maid, had a spirit and courage at least the match of yours. Yet she was doomed to wait upon an old man whom she loved as a father and watched him falling into a mean, dishonored dotage, and her part seemed to her more ignoble than that of the staff he leaned on."
Oh, wow.
End quote.
Yeah.
So she's really feeling the pangs of being a lady in these times. Now, Gandalf has showed up. In the movies, they're on the way to Helm's Deep, and Eowyn goes to Helm's Deep.
Right.
And you see a fairly similar scene, but in the books, Théoden actually says to Eowyn, "You have to stay with the people and lead the people to this other location because she's seen as fearless and all loved her." And so even though she wanted to go to Helm's Deep and participate in the battle, she reluctantly obeys his orders and stays behind as all of the other men ride off and fight in the Battle of Helm's Deep, the Battle of Hornburg. Then Aragorn is at one point about to ride into the mountains to attempt to take the paths of the dead. And
the dead people.
Right. And she tries to dissuade him from doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Unable to, she offers to accompany him, declaring herself, quote, weary of skulking in the hills and wish to face peril and battle.
Yes.
But Aragorn says, no, no, you were supposed to govern the people in the king's stead. You can't come.
Right.
And she responds, quote, all your words are but to say you are a woman and your part is in the house. But when men have died in battle and honor, you have to leave to be burned in the house, for the men will need it no more. But I am of the house of Errol and not a serving woman. I can ride and wield blade, and I do not fear either pain or death. And when he asks her what she does fear, she says, a cage.
Yes.
Pretty much Eowyn is my life.
Yeah.
Now, cut to a while later in the books and in the movies, right. And Denethor, who is keeping watch over Gondor, he's not the king, he's the steward of Gondor. He calls for Theoden's aid against Mordor, and Eowyn says, again, please let me come to this battle. I really want to go. And they say no. So finally, sick of it, she disguises herself as a man under the alias Durnhelm and rides to Minas Tirith. She takes Merry, the hobbit, and they both are kind of like sneak along and go. So good. So, so good. Now, during the Battle of Pelennor Fields, which is one of the many giant amazing battles in the books and in the movies, she fights in Theoden's escort. And when they are attacked by the Witch King of Angmar, Lord of the Nazgul, one of the creepy Ringwraiths guys,
right.
She and Merry are the only riders who don't flee. The little tiny guy and the woman.
The Hobbit and the woman.
Oh my God, that'd be such a cool title for an episode. The Witch King wounds Theoden, and Eowyn steps up to challenge him, and he boasts that no living man may hinder me, to which she responds by removing her helmet, exposing her long blonde hair, and she declares in the books a slightly longer declaration,
right.
Quote, no living man am I, you look upon a woman, Eowyn I am, Eowyn's daughter, you stand between me and my lord and kin, be gone if you be not deathless, for living or dark undead, I will smite you if you touch him. So Peter Jackson kind of condensed that a little bit into just, I am no man. Yeah. Stab.
That's amazing.
But it's all wonderful.
Can I tell you a quick side note?
Yes.
When I first watched that, I thought, little uneducated, unwoke me, I hated that scene. I thought it was such a cop-out that he dies by just her, like, tricking the prophecy, like, saying, like, I'm not a man, I'm a woman, so stab you in the face.
Have you read any Shakespeare?
It wasn't until middle school. And so it wasn't until I got to high school and I started like waking up that I was like, no, this is everything. This is how you win sometimes. It's just by
being a woman.
Well, changing the narrative, like playing someone.
Yes. This changing is what you said.
All right. This is what I'm going to do.
Semantics.
Exactly. Semantics.
So Eowyn stabs her sword through the Witch King's head, killing him and fulfilling the 1,000-year prophecy that not by the hand of man would the Witch King fall. Now, obviously in the movie, the scene is a little different. Merry comes up from behind and stabs the Witch King in the leg. He does also do that in the book. What they don't explain in the movie, because it's kind of hard to get into, is that the act of stabbing the Witch King almost kills both Merry and Eowyn because he's so full of evil.
Oh.
So they're both almost dead, not from wounds in battle, but just...
Because killing a being as pure evil as that has repercussions.
So Eowyn succumbs to a severe case of the Black Breath, which is a serious and fatal medical condition that results from contact with a Nazgul. In the book, Theoden is unaware that she was nearby, and before he dies, he tells Merry that she had been dearer than a daughter. In the movie, Eowyn manages
to see him, and they
speak to each other. Now, Éomer sees her lying in the battle and thinks that she's dead, temporarily goes mad when he thinks that she's dead. She charges the enemy, but then she's found by Prince Imrahil, who is the son of Elrond. He's not in the movies, just in the books.
He's
an elf. And he notices that she's, good job, that she's still alive and takes her to the Houses of Healing. That's where she is healed by Aragorn. And Eowyn remains in Minas Tirith while the Army of the West that she'd been fighting with marches to the Black Gate to challenge Sauron.
Right.
And in the Houses of Healing, she meets and falls in love with Faramir, who was injured by his father before the battle.
On the Burning Pyre?
Mm-hmm. The relationship between Eowyn and Faramir is mostly cut from the movies. They kind of give each other a look at the end, and those of us in the know are like, I get you,
but
other people don't. But there's just such beautiful writing in the book. And in the book, Faramir says to her, quote, then Eowyn of Rohan, I say to you that you are beautiful. In the valleys of our hills, there are flowers fair and bright and maidens fairer still. but neither flower nor lady have I seen till now in Gondor so lovely and so sorrowful. It may be that only a few days are left ere darkness falls upon our world, and when it comes I hope to face it steadily. But it would ease my heart if, while the sun yet shines, I could see you still, for you. End quote.
That's so sweet.
It's so beautiful.
The world's about to end, but will you hang out with me?
Right? Will you just chill with me for like a little?
That's amazing.
It's the best. And their relationship is the coolest.
Aww.
At Eowyn's insistence, Merry is made a knight of the Rittermark, a knight of Rohan. Mm-hmm. He attends Théoden's funeral and Éomer's coronation as the king of Rohan, where Eowyn presents him with a parting gift. Faramir and Eowyn then settle in Ithilien, where they have at least one son that we know of, and their grandson, Barahir, wrote the tale of Aragorn and Arwen in the Fourth Age. Her date of death is nowhere recorded.
Wow.
The end.
Fantastic. I loved her already.
But do you love her even more?
Yes. Great. That moment. Now I do. Usually when I watch Lord of the Rings now, and don't be mad at me, I fast forward through all of Frodo and Sam. That's fine. It's just so boring.
I'm not mad at you. Me. It is kind of boring.
They're just walking for three movies for like 9 hours. All the exciting stuff happens to Aragorn and Legolas and Gimli and the battles at
Helm's Deep
and Minas Tirith and all these other places.
The thing is, I can't believe I hadn't thought to do Eowyn before now because she's so good.
She's so good. But now that moment when she said, "I am no man," and stabs it, and then his helmet
crumples. So good.
So good. All right. So, Jadis, the White Witch. So she comes technically first in The Magician's Nephew, which is the series of books that comes before The Chronicles of Narnia and sets up the world that Narnia takes place in. You see the creation of Narnia in The Magician's Nephew.
But the series The Chronicles of Narnia starts with The Magician's Nephew. There's not a series before.
Oh, I thought it was separate from The Chronicles.
No. So there's a little bit of a debate in, I don't know, I guess literary circles, in the order in which you should read The Chronicles of Narnia, because the order in which they are published is different from their chronological order. Okay. So The Magician's Nephew is first chronologically, you do see the creation of Narnia, but I believe it was published later. The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe was published first. The sort of chronological way to read the books is Magician's Nephew, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, The Horse and His Boy, Prince Caspian, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, The Silver Chair, The Last Battle.
So there's
7 books.
Yeah.
And if you buy them in a box set, you may see the numbers on the books different depending on the order that is chosen.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I have read all of them. It's been a minute since I've read the last couple, but I have read Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
That's fine. You don't need to read The Last Battle again.
I love... Yeah. They do kind of asymptote in terms of how good they are once they get down to the last ones.
The Last Battle just makes my feminist sensibilities scream.
Ah, all right.
I can get into that later. But go on, Jadis. Let's hear it.
So, Chronicles of Narnia, written by C.S. Lewis. So she, the White Witch, was created by C.S. Lewis. She appears in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, The Magician's Nephew, Prince Caspian, and The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. And she's technically half giant and half djinn. And djinn is an ancient term for what became genie. So like from Aladdin, all powerful mystical beings. And apparently also descended from Lilith, who we've done in a prior episode.
I didn't know that.
In the BBC series The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, she was portrayed by Barbara Kellerman. And then of course Tilda Swinton did her so wonderfully in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And also in Prince Caspian as well.
Eowyn, of course, was portrayed wonderfully by Miranda Otto in
so good
all of the Lord of the Rings films.
So good. A little bit of history before we see her. She was born into the ruling family on Charn, which is a world that was once lively and populated by members of a giant hybrid, giant djinn race, now aged into nearly nothingness by the time she first comes around.
Mm-hmm.
She practiced witchcraft in her childhood on Charn, but much more than what was considered proper for their race at the time. She delved deep into dark magic, determined to learn everything it had to offer. And through this study, she discovers an ancient spell that would destroy all living things except the caster. And it's called the Deplorable Word, which became her greatest weapon. She became engaged in a political struggle with her own sister for the crown, warring for 3 days until Jadis's army had been devastated, and only she herself remained. Originally, the sisters had made a pact to refrain from using magic in this battle between them.
Mm-hmm.
And although Jadis claims her sister used it first, when they met the final time, rather than surrendering, Jadis uttered the Deplorable Word. wiped out every living thing on Charn and getting herself named queen by default because she's the only living thing left.
Right.
Ugh. With no one left, she puts a spell on herself and turns herself into stone because, you know, she's got that wand where she can stab people. She turns herself into stone on the chance that someone might stumble into her world at some point and she'd have new subjects to rule over. One of them ringing the bell that was supposed to bring her back to life. So she remains a statue for centuries until two children named Polly and Diggory, now we're in the magician's nephew, stumble into Charn by way of the wood between the worlds. And if I remember this correctly, because it's been a minute, this is a world that they, how do they get into that world? It's a big world full of like puddles, right? That they can jump in and out of.
So Diggory's uncle is kind of a crazy old magician, thus the magician's nephew. And he transports them there by use of magical rings. Non-spoiler alert, C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien were friends.
Yes, they were.
Rings, common theme, apparently, doing magic by via rings. So he sends Polly and Diggory unknowingly into this wood between the worlds that, yes, is essentially full of puddles, and it's kind of an intermediary between all these different universes.
Right.
And any puddle that you go into leads you into a different world.
A whole other world. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the ways to get into Narnia
without
going through a wardrobe.
Correct.
Right. If you're going to actually find Narnia on purpose, you go through the wood between the worlds. So Polly and Diggory, they get into this wood, wood between the worlds. They accidentally ring the bell and are forced to return to their world with Jadis in tow. Jadis gets all the way back to Earth at this point, to their world.
Right.
Jadis discovers that she's very weak. Her powers aren't at their fullest when they're on Earth or in this world between. And she begins attempting to take over just by sheer force and mayhem. And she goes crazy. She grabs a part of a lamppost and starts swinging it at people. And she actually brings it back into the real world.
Right.
After squaring off with police in the real world in London and swinging at them with the part of the lamppost she'd ripped out of the ground, Diggory managed to transport her, a cab horse and driver, his uncle, and Polly back through the wood between the worlds using the magic rings that they'd originally used to get there.
Mm-hmm.
This time, however, instead of landing in Charn, they land in the as yet unborn world of Narnia. And if I remember this correctly, each of these puddles, if the world wasn't already created in the puddle, it was kind of like just a puddle of magic. And as soon as you went into it, it created...
No, Narnia is created by Aslan singing.
The six of them, Jadis, the cab horse driver, his uncle, and Polly, become unknowing witnesses to the birth of Narnia, where they encounter the great lion Aslan, who is also a figure for Jesus.
Yes.
Yes. Jadis hurls the lamppost at Aslan, and it strikes the ground, and it grows a new lamppost, which is where, if you've read the Chronicles of Narnia, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, when they come across that lamppost, that is the lamppost that she throws. It puts into the ground, and because, oh, this is what I'm thinking, because the world is so new,
anything that you put there grows.
Exactly.
Yes.
And that's Aslan who did not the world itself.
Right.
And so because this gets put into the ground, it just grows up into a brand new lamppost, which is how the lamppost is lit. That's a question that I've heard people ask before. How does the lamppost, what's lighting it? It's just magic. It just is what it is. So after it grows up into this new lamppost, she realizes the world that she's in and she flees, realizing that it's a brand new world that didn't contain evil yet. And she might have an opening there. She later comes upon a tree of youth as she's going around Narnia, and she ate from it a silver apple, granting her inexhaustible strength and immortality, but at a really high price. Because she stole it rather than it being offered to her, she would now never know peace or happiness, only misery. And being immortal, her misery would literally never end.
Oy.
The fruit then actually repelled her. And it kept her away for centuries from Narnia, where she lived in the wild lands of the north for about 900 years, biding her time and gathering forces so that she could go back and attack Narnia.
Mm-hmm.
So now we get into The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Right.
When the Tree of Youth dies, the tree that she ate the apple from, Jadis was able to return to Narnia, declared herself Queen of Narnia, Empress of the Lone Islands, and she caused a winter to fall for over 100 years. And the winter, I didn't know this until I read this research, was to prevent more silver apple trees from being grown. Because if the apple tree came back up, she'd be repelled again.
Right.
She becomes known as the White Witch, declaring herself supreme ruler and establishing a secret police, as well as banning Christmas and Father Christmas, as well as humans from Narnia, because there was a prophecy, which we hear about in Chronicles of Narnia, the Golden Age prophecy, which says that she would be overthrown two sons of Adam, two daughters of Eve.
Right. Yes.
She comes across a human boy in Narnia one day named Edmund Pevensey, who told her that his sister Lucy had visited once before and met a faun called Tumnus, who had helped build her home. After bribing Edmund with sweets,
Turkish delight,
she persuades him to return and to bring all of his siblings to her with him when he comes back, but he doesn't. And so she imprisons him as a way to lure the three other siblings to her.
Mm-hmm.
Word traveled to her that at the same time, Aslan was returning, so she began to prepare for war, which then began in the spring of the year 1000. Jadis began to weaken with Aslan's return and the subsequent return of spring, so again, she turned to her manipulative powers. After an attack on her encampment, which rescued Edmund, she invoked her legal claim over Edmund's life due to the debt that he owed her.
Right.
But Aslan offered himself instead on the stone table. And she executes Aslan. She stabs him. Or no, she cuts his throat.
I'm not sure what it says in the book, but I think in the movie, it's a stabbing.
It's a stabbing. She shaves his mane to humiliate him and then stabs him. However, she fails to realize that Aslan's sacrifice brought him back to life because he is the Jesus figure.
Or the Lily Potter figure, though she didn't come back to life. But
correct.
Sacrifice, very important in literary circles.
Absolutely. And quite powerful magic as well.
Yes.
Yeah. He arrives at the very last battle the following day and he kills Jadis. Aslan becomes the one to just finally do it. 100 years later, there was an attempt made to resurrect the White Queen through a ritual called the Blue Fire, but it was unsuccessful, and she never quite makes it back into the real world. But because she is immortal, she died physically, but she didn't die mortally. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So that's Jadis.
Cool.
Yes. A badass bitch who does what she wants.
That's right.
Evil, but...
she gets it done.
Exactly.
The Bitchery of History is brought to you by Audible.com.
You can download a free book and start a free trial by going to audibletrial.com/bitchery.
This week, I will recommend My Life in France by Julia Child.
Oh, I love Julia Child.
I know. It's great.
What's the book?
My Life in France.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to be hungry while you're driving. Have you seen the Drunk History episode on Julia Child?
No.
Do you know she was a spy?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. So it goes in, her life is incredible. And if you want to be entertained and... whet your appetite while driving.
Yes.
Go to audibletrial.com/bitchery.
Yes. Hey, y'all. If you're enjoying the podcast, do us a favor and look down at your phone or your computer and give us a rating or a review. Those ratings and reviews help other people find the podcast, which helps us keep doing the podcast. Thanks. So today in Herstory.
Mm-hmm. On May 21st, 1881, Clara Barton establishes the American Red Cross in Washington, D.C.
And then on May 23rd, 1533, Catherine of Aragon's marriage to King Henry VIII is declared null and void.
First
wife.
On May 26th, 1647, Alcee Young is hanged in Hartford, Connecticut, becoming the first person executed as a witch in the American colonies.
Oh, we need to do the Salem witch trials at some point.
Yes.
Just do an entire episode on that.
Yes.
Fantastic.
I'll recommend The Witch of Blackbird Pond as a book.
Yes. Term of the week?
Yes.
All right. So I came across, in research, looking for terms to try and define, mm-hmm. I came across this thing called Moth's Law. And if you were to phrase it as a parallel to Godwin's Law, it would go like this. As comments continue in a feminist, quote, social justice discussion of pop culture, the probability of someone saying, why do you have to analyze it? It's just a movie, cartoon, or book, approaches 1. So it approaches 100%.
Okay.
So it's basically saying in any conversation you have discussing the merits or...
discussing gender issues in the media, someone will say, why do you have to analyze it? It's just pop culture.
Just enjoy
it. Sit back and relax.
Exactly.
Well, how about how huge an industry that it is and how much a part of the conversation and that art is part of our culture and what our culture says reflects back to us, what we do reflects back in our culture. And if you want to change this endless circle, you've got to start somewhere. And the way that we see... gender, race, sexuality represented in movies, television, plays, etc., will influence and have influence on how we perceive those in life.
Right. I think it's an argument that really doesn't hold much water sitting in the entertainment industry and kind of working where I've been working. And I know you trying to make it as an actor or making it as an actor. You've got stuff coming out. Mm-hmm. The things that get made nowadays in Hollywood mm-hmm. are the things that are commercially viable, right? Because that's what this is. This is a business after all.
Right.
So if we're talking about this got made and this got made in a way that is seen by everybody, then those things that get seen by everyone, there has to be some kind of social argument to be made that this got made because it is commercially viable, which means that this is something that all of us as a culture accept as being true.
Right. Which is sometimes good and sometimes worth making a comment about.
Exactly.
I was reading an article, totally forget what the organization was, but they are coming up with a seal or a stamp like the Humane Association's, you know, No Animals Were Harmed, saying that this project had gender equality in terms of the crew and the cast and how things are treated.
I like that.
Which is awesome.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This website I found, it's called geekfeminism.wikia.com, says this. The reason why the argument of, quote, it's just a book / game / movie / TV show, etc., is wrong is that culture informs society. And a creative work that perpetuates hatred, misinformation, or other bad things can have an effect on large amounts of people. However subtle that effect may be, degrading society to some extent as a whole.
Correct.
So yeah, Moff's Law. I thought that was interesting.
I like it. I like that I have a term for it now.
Absolutely.
I know I said that last week, but I really do. Because people definitely say, oh, well, why does it matter? That they come up with an excuse in every movie for the woman to either get undressed or...
Right.
I never understood, even as a little girl, why when women get captured by villains, mm-hmm. do they always make them put on a different outfit? What is that? It literally makes no sense.
Yeah.
And it's just an excuse, either on the side of the villain or the director or both, or, you know, or the filmmakers to go, well, we have this attractive woman who looks like she's, you know, crawled across the desert, Indiana Jones and Raiders of the Lost Ark. Mm-hmm. So we need to put her in a really nice dress so she's really, really good looking.
And when you think about it, a movie is never just a movie. Just like a radio show is never just a radio show. A book is never just a book. In each one of these different mediums, you have tons of people working on these things.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if you're watching Star Wars, a movie that is as big as Star Wars, and I'm not saying that Star Wars is, you know, whatever, but if you're watching a movie that's that big as Star Wars, and you have a character like Rey, who is the main character in the most recent one, that was a decision that was made not by one person, not even by maybe 10 people. That was probably a decision that had many different people influencing it.
Right.
And so for you to then just say, or for someone to then just say, it's just a book, it's just a movie, it's not. It's a piece of culture that was created by hundreds and hundreds of people. So it's almost like a little microcosm, a little experiment on society as a whole.
Yeah. Well, the reason Star Trek Voyager is my favorite Star Trek is always because Captain Janeway.
Love
her. She was my hero growing up.
I bet she was.
Oh, of course she was.
Yeah.
Love it.
So what's our term for the week?
We already talked about it.
So what's our cause for the week?
Our cause for the week is First Book. First Book is a nonprofit social enterprise or nonprofit group that helps provide new books, learning materials, and other essentials to children in need. Literacy is a huge issue.
Huge.
And access to books and learning materials, it can be a huge financial burden.
Absolutely.
Dang, children's books are expensive. Did you know? You probably don't know, but I babysit and some of those cardboard books are like $20.
Yeah. Well, I have a 5-year-old brother and a 12-year-old sister.
So you know.
Absolutely.
So First Book is a great organization that's helping provide those books and materials to families in need.
Since being founded in 1992, they've distributed more than 160 million books and educational research to programs and schools serving children from low-income families. It's fantastic. I say often, and this is a quote directly pulled from The West Wing, education is the silver bullet. Education is everything.
I agree.
The Bitry of History is a production of Ursula Major Productions. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at UMPBOH. On Facebook, just search The Bitry of History.
We also have an amazing new website up made by Sydney. It's UMPBOH.com, UMPBOH.com, and it's gorgeous.
Yes. Speaking about Sydney, let's give a shout out to the rest of the production team too.
Olivia.
Ashley.
Kim.
Jeanette.
Steph.
And Dan.
Thanks, guys.
Seriously.
For great real. Work.
Yeah.
And remember, for just a couple dollars a month or a couple dollars a podcast, you can help us make this incredible show happen, spreading education around the world via patreon.com/UrsulaMajor.
Yes.
And as always, bitches get stuff done.